One of the criticisms made against the SSPX comes not from the Novus Ordo crowd, but from Sede Vacantists, people who you would think would be our closest allies. And although this claim is not new, I have noticed its proclamation has gotten louder since the announcement and subsequent consecration of four bishops by the SSPX on July 1st. Now, I personally have nothing against Sede Vacantists or even Sede Vacantism. I don't believe their clergy or sacraments are invalid. I don't see them as schismatic, nor am I saying you can't save your soul as a Sede Vacantist. This is not an attack on Sede Vacantism, but rather a critique of it, brought on by a criticism many Sede Vacantists make against the SSPX, that I believe needs to be answered. If you like what you see, please like and share the video and subscribe to the channel, turning on all notifications. If you would like to support this channel, you can do so through Buy Me a Coffee. The link is in the description. Those who have bought coffees since the premiere of my last video and the recording of this one are Patrice. You can also like and follow me on Facebook, X, Rumble, BitChute, and Substack. My first book, Until the Last Penny, is available both in ebook and paperback forms. It's a fictional story of a soul's journey through purgatory, and it's unapologetically Catholic. Get your copy by clicking the link in the description. And special thanks to Chloe Blattert and De Matteo for leaving reviews on Amazon. The claim against the SSPX made by Sede Vacantists goes like this. If you believe these men are in fact popes, then you must accept their teaching and obey. You must accept Vatican II in its entirety and the new Mass. You must do what they tell you. I heard one of them say that if Leo XIV is truly the pope, then consecrating these bishops without approval is in fact schism, which I find very interesting coming from Sede Vacantists. I heard one of them say that the SSPX is liberal Catholicism, which of course is ridiculous. Now, to be fair, this has always been part of their rhetoric. More than once I've heard them say something needs to be done about the SSPX. Why? Because when people see the problems in the church, they typically start going to an indult mass or an SSPX chapel before considering Sede Vacantism, because it feels safer. Now, I could care less if someone is a Sede Vacantist. I am the easiest guy to get along with. If you feel Sede Vacantism is the only answer, I get it. This is the conclusion you came to, and I'm not going to argue with you. Likewise, if you want to stick with the Novus Ordo because that's what the church says to do, that's your business. We're all Catholic. That's the way I see it. But since this criticism from Sede Vacantists has increased since the announcement of the consecrations, I want to give, as best I can, the case for the SSPX over Sede Vacantism, because in my opinion, these are the only two real possibilities. And I'm sure there are people better than me out there to do this, but here goes. The church is in a crisis. The new Mass, false ecumenism, religious liberty, the blessing of same-sex couples, communion for the divorced and remarried, collegiality, the new rites of ordination and consecration for priests and bishops, synodality, and pachymama, just to name a few. And those of us in the know can't go along with these changes. Over the decades, theories have surfaced as to why this is happening and what it means. For the purposes of this video, we are only interested in one, Sede Vacantism. Classic Sede Vacantism, not the recent Pope Benedict XVI was the last legitimate pope, but rather the original Sede Vacantism that says Pope Pius XII or John XXIII was the last legitimate pope. Going forward, we will call this Sede Vacantism. And if Sede Vacantism can't prove itself, the SSPX position wins by default. So, let's look at the claim of Sede Vacantism and why I, at least, reject it. According to Sede Vacantists, the visible church was fine in 1958. The papacy, all the bishops and priests, were valid and legitimate. What presented itself to the world as the Catholic Church was, in fact, the Catholic Church. But within 10 years, these same priests and bishops lost their office and the See of Rome became vacant, and nobody noticed until later. Then the true Catholic Church went underground. The same visible entity comprised of the same men was in fact the Catholic Church in 1958, then all of a sudden, it was the false church. The same visible organization with the exact same men went from the one true church to a false church, presumably overnight, and nobody noticed for at least 10 years or more. How is that possible? How is that not the gates of hell prevailing against the church? The claim on the surface is absurd. Now, that doesn't mean it's wrong, but it is a fantastic claim, an extraordinary claim, which requires extraordinary evidence. First of all, realize the burden of proof is on you, the sedevacantists. So the fact that perhaps sedevacantism cannot be disproven is irrelevant. I don't have to disprove it. You have to prove it, beyond more than a reasonable doubt. After all, the salvation of souls is at stake, and quite frankly, the safer bet is against it. I've heard interesting arguments, points that I can't refute perhaps, but I don't believe the burden of proof for sedevacantism has been met. If for no other reason, there is always a counter-argument. As long as there is a viable path away from sedevacantism loses. Because it has to prove its position. We don't have to prove ours. We don't have to answer why we reject it. Rejection of sedevacantism is the standard position. The claim of sedevacantism is on the same level as claiming we didn't go to the moon, or that the place we live on is not a spinning ball. Those claims, as well as sedevacantism, may be right. They all have compelling arguments, but they are so counter to what we see as reality that if there is a counter-argument at all, even if it's a little weaker, those claims lose. And the reason I'm hammering this home is because some sedevacantists act like we do have to answer as to why we're not sedevacantists, and that if we can't answer this or that argument, then we are guilty and culpable of not being sedevacantists. So, just to beat a dead horse, the burden of proof lies with the sedevacantists, and it's a high burden, one that I don't believe has been met, nor can be, quite frankly. It would take a proclamation from the church that these men were all antipopes for me to accept it. Anything less than that is human reasoning. I'm sorry, but saying, why don't you see it? Or, I just don't understand why people don't see it, or refuse to see it, or it's so obvious, why don't you guys accept it, is not an argument. Shaming or bullying people into shutting up or accepting your position, which I see sedevacantist apologists do frequently, is quite frankly a leftist tactic. Now again, if someone is a sedevacantist and they say, well, this is my opinion, this is what makes sense to me, this is what I believe, fine. You're following your conscience. I'm not going to say you're a schismatic or anything like that. This is the conclusion you came to make sense of the chaos and confusion in the church, and I don't fault anyone for that. But don't tell me I have to accept it. And don't tell me I have to either accept sedevacantism or the Novus Ordo with all its craziness. I think that's the real beef sedevacantists have with the SSPX. It gives people an escape from the Novus Ordo without being sedevacantist, because nobody wants to be a sedevacantist. So, here are some arguments against sedevacantism. And yes, I know sedevacantists have answers for all of these. I've heard those answers, and you're missing the point. It's not a matter of simply overcoming objections. Sedevacantists have to prove they're right. And yes, I'm hammering that home, because so many of them act like they don't have a burden of proof, that the burden of proof is more with us. So here goes. The church must be visible. And I'm sorry, I don't accept this, oh, well, it is visible, see, I'm here, I'm online, I'm a bishop, I'm a priest, we're the Diamond Brothers, we're right here. I'm sorry, but the visibility of the church has to be more than that. The world has to be able to look and say, there's the Catholic Church. Otherwise, literally anybody can make that claim. Protestants can make that claim, and some do. Every small little gathering of people can make that claim, like Mary's Little Remnant or the Diamond Brothers. Then we start arguing over who the real remnant is. That's not a visible church. The First Vatican Council says there will be shepherds and pastors until the end of time, and that Peter will have perpetual successors until the end of time. In order, then, that the episcopal office should be one and undivided, and that by the union of the clergy, the whole multitude of believers should be held together in the unity of faith and communion, he set Blessed Peter over the rest of the apostles and instituted in him the permanent principle of both unities, the unity of faith and communion, and their visible foundation. So right here in Vatican I, it says that the Pope is the visibility of the church. It doesn't say this or that bishop and clergy and podcaster scattered here and there who are loosely connected. Continuing. Therefore, if anyone says that it is not by the institution of Christ, the Lord himself, that is to say, by divine law, that Blessed Peter should have perpetual successors in the primacy over the whole church, or that the Roman pontiff is not the successor of Blessed Peter in his primacy. Let him be anathema. Leo XIII said, Christ instituted in the church a living, authoritative, and permanent magisterium. Pius XI said, the teaching authority of the church is daily exercised through the Roman pontiff and the bishops who are in communion with him. The living magisterium, which means the pope and the bishops, not a collection of books, is permanent, and the teaching authority is exercised daily. The seat of Peter remaining vacant for even a few years is no big deal and doesn't show these statements to be wrong. The structure of the church, its integrity that is dependent on the papacy for the living magisterium and its daily activities can survive that. But any reasonable person can see that the church cannot survive an extended period that's gone on for decades with no end in sight. I believe the recent movement among some sedevacantists to elect a pope is a tacit admission of this, and its rejection by others, the recognition that that person will undoubtedly be an antipope. If sedevacantism is correct, jurisdiction, which is dependent on the papacy, will die with the last bishop appointed by the last pope. Pius XII said, the power of jurisdiction, which is conferred upon the supreme pontiff directly by divine right, flows to the bishops by the same right, but only through the successor of Peter. Of course, they'll point out, there have been antipopes throughout history. Yes, scattered here and there, or alongside legitimate popes. Nothing that would destroy jurisdiction like their proposal does. And how do we know about these antipopes? The church told us. The church made a declaration. And there was never a period longer than a few years of the chair being empty. And by the way, saints backed antipopes, so I don't believe this is a matter of anyone's particular salvation to erroneously believe this or that man is the pope if they believed with good reason, and the fact that the visible church in the world recognizes this man is the pope is certainly good reason. They'll say the new rites are invalid just like the Anglican rites are invalid, and therefore the bishops and priests of the new rite are invalid. Yes, the Anglican rites are invalid, and how do we know this? Pope Leo XIII told us. The church made a declaration. That's what it takes. Anything else is human reasoning. I may not have a good answer for some of their points, but I don't have to accept their conclusion, because there may be an answer, and even if there's not, they could still be wrong. In this situation, I believe accepting these popes are real is the safer position. And as far as the new rites go, go to the SSPX and you don't have to worry about it. But if it is true, then it's all gone. There are no more valid priests and bishops except the SSPX and sedevacantists. But more importantly, jurisdiction is gone. I know they'll say supply jurisdiction. Yes, but regular jurisdiction cannot die out. And if regular jurisdiction dies out, does supply jurisdiction die with it? I don't know. And how is it all going to be put back together? Or is this it? The church is gone. By the way, I do accept the new rites. Why? Because the church has not proclaimed them invalid, and the SSPX did an independent study and found they are valid when done properly. Eucharistic miracles and exorcism. Sedevacantists do not like being confronted with Eucharistic miracles in the Novus Ordo or their lack of miracles. Now, I don't think they need miracles. But I do believe the modern post-Vatican II Eucharistic miracles testify to the validity of the new orders and the new Mass. These are not just claims. These are phenomena that have gone through scientific testing, and they can't just be dismissed, especially since they speak directly to the issue of the validity of the new rites and the new Mass. One of the arguments St. Francis de Sales used against the Protestants was their lack of miracles. Pope Leo XIII said that God proves his church through miracles. By the way, the reason I don't believe the SSPX and sedevacantists need miracles is because they are not outside of the church. Cajetan said, if someone, for a reasonable motive, holds the person of the pope in suspicion and refuses his presence, even his jurisdiction, he does not commit the delict of schism, nor any other whatsoever, provided that he be ready to accept the pope were he not held in suspicion. It goes without saying that one has the right to avoid what is harmful and to ward off dangers. And while I do personally recognize the Pope's conciliar popes as legitimate, I do see why others would hold them in suspicion. Exorcists and those involved in exorcism testify to the authority that the post-Vatican II priests and bishops have over the demons by virtue of their office. Offices they received by virtue of the new rites, obviously. Now, you can say these are all lies, but without proof, that's calumny. Sedevacantism is safe. One of the arguments Sedevacantists use is that being a Sedevacantist is safe, since the post-Vatican II Church is so ecumenical and recognizes the good and salvific character of other religions to the point of discouraging conversion, saying people don't even need to become Catholic to be saved. This certainly would extend to Sedevacantists. And while I think this is generally true, it's not true for everyone. Past marriages and annulments become problematic. Not everyone is lucky enough to enjoy the perfect trad family existence. And trust me, I'm not knocking that, making fun of it, or anything like that. If you have that situation, cherish it and realize how lucky you are. If you are being raised in it, don't leave it. Marry someone who shares that upbringing, even if it is Sedevacantist, and stay in it. Don't make the mistakes a lot of us have made in life. Some of us aren't so lucky. Some of us have complicated pasts and have come to tradition late in life. Take me, for example. Before you assume, no, this is not why I reject Sedevacantism, but it is something that I would have to take into consideration were I to actually consider it. I was married previously and got an annulment. That woman is deceased, so that's not an issue. Besides, I have no doubt that that marriage was not valid. A couple of hours before the ceremony, the boys and I went out to a bar and shared a few pitchers to get rid of the jitters. I wasn't hammered during the ceremony, but I wasn't exactly sober either, and yeah, I did that on purpose. I lived a much different life back then, and I withheld my intent. I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time, but I went into that marriage fully expecting that we would get divorced, that it would probably be me who initiated it, even though it wasn't, and I would marry someone else. And I did marry again. My wife was also married previously and got a dissolution of bond through patrine privilege by Pope John Paul II because her previous husband was not baptized, though she was, when they got married. The Pope has the authority to dissolve such marriages, even if they are valid. If Sedevacantism is correct and John Paul II was never Pope, then that dissolution of bond is invalid and she's still married to that other guy. If I were to accept Sedevacantism, then I would necessarily have to end our marriage and tell her to go back to the other guy. I would destroy my family and my life, drive my children from ever returning to the faith. They've all left. But more importantly, if Sedevacantism is wrong, which I believe that it is, and I followed through with all of that, then I would be guilty of causing my wife to commit adultery, and her and I would end up in hell, because we were actually married, which we are, I have no doubt. Now, tell me that I have to accept Sedevacantism. Tell me that it's safe. Do you really think that I'm going to destroy my life, my wife's life, my family, because maybe I can't answer this or that point that you've raised? For me, it would take a declaration from the church that these men were antipopes, which isn't happening anytime soon, and probably not in my lifetime. And I am far from the only person who would have to destroy their families to accept Sedevacantism. I'm not talking about the rank and file who marry, divorce, and then remarry at will. I'm talking about people who actually care and get annulments, then married with the church's permission. And you don't think you have an incredible burden of proof? You'd better be able to prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt if you're going to demand that of people, refuse them the sacraments, etc. Yes, I know the new annulments can be questionable. The SSPX recognizes that as well, but they also accept them. Archbishop Lefebvre accepted them. That's one of the issues that the Nine, who basically created American Sedevacantism, had with Lefebvre. But I also believe that people in the last few decades do not have the same understanding about marriage as people did up until even 100 years ago, me having been one of them. So yes, I believe a lot more marriages are invalid today, even over the last several decades compared to past generations. Our Lady of Fatima said many marriages today aren't good. That was in 1917. What do you think that means? It means they were not valid. Now, you might say if those annulments are invalid or John Paul II was not Pope, then we are committing adultery anyway. Perhaps. But again, I think this is the safer side to err on. I think God will be much more understanding until proven otherwise, the status quo stays. If a pope falls into heresy, he loses his office. These popes have clearly fallen into error and heresy, therefore they have lost their office. This is the core argument of sedevacantism, and yes, it's a solid argument. It is the common opinion of the doctors and saints that if a pope falls into heresy, he loses his office. The problem is the details of how that works, what triggers the loss of office, and how it is to be handled have not yet been worked out. Does it have to be formal and pertinacious? Does any manifestation of heresy automatically depose a pope? Does he have to be removed by the church? Or can he even be removed? Since no one can judge the pope, is it that we are stuck with a heretical pope without resolution? None of this has been resolved, nor has it officially been declared that a pope does lose his office if he falls into heresy. There are schools of thought. The idea that a pope loses his office automatically if he becomes a manifest heretic is one school of thought, St. Robert Bellarmine's. But we don't have to accept that Bellarmine is correct. Even he said there were other opinions, like Cajetan and Suarez, who said that a pope who is manifestly heretical is not deposed by that very fact. They taught that a manifest heretical pope is not deposed automatically, but that he can and should be deposed by the church, and that he remains pope until the church removes him. And in the case of heresy, the church does have that authority. It may be the minority opinion, it may have problems, but I think an argument can be made that Bellarmine's view also has problems. For instance, the fact that the church doesn't operate the way he proposes. Popes in the past have manifested heresy, and the church has never said, and they ceased being pope, or, and they lost their office. Liberius signed a semi-heretical creed. Honorius I was condemned as a heretic by an ecumenical council. Pope John XXII said that those in heaven did not have the beatific vision and wouldn't until after the final judgment. Yes, I know that sedevacantists have answers for these popes, but it's not enough to show that their belief that a heretical pope loses his office can survive heretical popes who did not lose their office. And I also reject the idea that the pope can err on a matter that has not been officially declared, but once it's declared, he can't, such as the case with Pope John XXII and Honorius I. If it's heresy, then it was heresy before it was officially declared. And if it's impossible for a pope to fall into heresy without losing his office, then it doesn't matter if it was before the official declaration. And I'm saying this mainly concerning John XXII, because that's the answer I've gotten when I've asked sedevacantists why he didn't lose his office, because what he was saying had not been officially condemned yet or something like that. But if it wasn't the common theology of the time that those in heaven get the beatific vision, then why did so many people fight him on it? So it clearly was what most people believed. Otherwise, they would just say, oh, well, the pope said this, I guess it's true. And how could we be sure of any pope throughout history? How can we be sure there's ever been a pope? Even Peter told Gentiles to obey Jewish dietary laws. Did he lose his office? Yet, to my knowledge, the church has never said that any pope has lost his office due to heresy. But here's the one that kills it for me. Pope Nicholas I said that heretics baptized in the name of Jesus only do not need to be rebaptized, which was against what had already been established. Pope Damasus I in 382 explicitly required baptism in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, anathematizing divisions or omissions that undermine the one Godhead in three persons. Pope St. Gregory II in 726 declared it. Pope Zachary in 741, he reigned from 741 to 752, and you can find this in Denzinger 297a. He says, he decrees and judgment is firmly commanded and diligently demonstrated so that whosoever had been washed without the invocation of the Trinity, he has not been perfected unless he shall have been baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Yet after all those popes explicitly declaring baptism must have the Trinitarian formula to be valid, Pope Nicholas I, who reigned from 858 to 867, in a letter to the Bulgarians in 866, and you can find this in Denzinger 335, wrote, if indeed they have been baptized in the name of the Holy Trinity or only in the name of Christ, as we read in the Acts of the Apostles, surely it is one and the same as St. Ambrose sets forth. it is established that they should not be baptized again. This, in my opinion, is a public manifestation of heresy. Did Pope Nicholas I lose his office? If so, where does the church say that he did? If you say that he did lose his office without being able to show where the church says that he did, then you are simply imposing your post-Vatican II theology of sedevacantism, and that's not good enough. Ex cum appellatus officio by Pope Paul, I think that's Paul IV, in 1559, says that a heretic cannot become pope. This is a judicial act. Basically, he's saying that a Protestant cannot be elected pope. It's rules for a conclave, not magisterial teaching, and thus can be and has been overturned. The 1917 Code of Canon Law stated that when it takes effect, all prior universal and particular laws, customs, and privileges contrary to its decrees are abrogated unless a specific exception is made. A brief mention in the footnotes does not make a specific exception. And Pope Pius XII said this before Pope John XXIII was elected, quote, "None of the cardinals may in any way or by pretext or reason of any excommunication, suspension, or interdict whatsoever, or of any other ecclesiastical impediment, be excluded from the active and passive election of the Supreme Pontiff. We hereby suspend such censures solely for the purpose of the said election. At other times, they are to remain vigor." One could argue that the reason a pope loses his office for heresy is because being a heretic comes with an automatic excommunication. Well, the 1917 Code of Canon Law, number 2264, says, "An act of jurisdiction carried out by an excommunicated person, whether in the internal or external forum, is illicit. And if a condemnatory or declaratory sentence has been pronounced, it is also invalid, without prejudice to Canon 2261. Otherwise, it is valid. To me, this is strong evidence that a declaration from the church is required to remove the pope, and until then, the judicial acts of that pope, such as a declaration of dissolution of bond by a patrician privilege, are valid." The idea that a pope loses his office thanks to manifest heresy is far from being as settled as sedevacantists seem to claim that it is. And it may be the case that we are simply stuck with a heretical pope who, although perhaps he has lost his office, remains valid with all his judicial acts valid because there is no higher authority to declare him excommunicated and remove him from office while he is alive. And it may have to wait for a future pope to make the declaration. We just won't know until the church takes it upon herself to settle this issue. But are we bound to give such a valid pope who falls into heresy absolute obedience? This goes to the heart of the claim that if we believe that he is truly the pope, we must obey him. This is the same hyper-papalistic view that is believed by Novus Ordo Catholics and Protestants. But the answer is actually no. Many saints and theologians have said so. Juan de Torquemada said, "If the Roman pontiff commands something that is evil in itself, that is contrary to divine law, to the faith, or to the salvation of souls, in such a case, separating oneself from the Roman pontiff by disobedience is not illicit and consequently should not be called schism." St. Robert Bellarmine himself said, "Just as it is illicit to resist the pontiff who attacks the body, so also is it licit to resist him who attacks the soul or destroys the civil order or, above all, tries to destroy the church. I say that it is illicit to resist him by not doing what he orders and by impeding the execution of his will." St. Thomas Aquinas teaches, "The abuse of authority can occur when what is commanded by the superior is contrary to the end for which that authority was instituted. For example, when he orders an evil act, contrary to the virtue that this authority is intended to promote and protect. In this case, not only is one not obliged to obey the superior, but one is even obliged not to obey him, as the holy martyrs face death rather than obey the impious orders of tyrants." And Leo XIII said, "Moreover, if the unjust order of the superior constitutes a danger to the faith, the disobedience itself must be public." St. Vincent of Lorenz said, What if some novel contagion seek to infect not merely an insignificant portion of the church, but the whole? Then it will be his care to cleave to antiquity, which at this day cannot possibly be seduced by any fraud of novelty. Though we, he says, or an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. Galatians 1:8. Why does he say, though we? Why not rather, though I? He means, though Peter, though Andrew, though John, in a word, though the whole company of apostles preach unto you other than we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. Tremendous severity, he spares neither himself nor his fellow apostles, so he may preserve unaltered the faith which was first delivered. Notice St. Vincent doesn't spare Peter. Even if Peter preaches something other than the authentic faith, we cling to antiquity, the ancient faith. And he does not say, but if Peter does, he loses his office. He just says that you resist it no matter who it is. There's no reason to go there. Let God and the church work that out. So as you can see, the argument that says we must either accept the Novus Ordo and all its craziness or adopt sedevacantism presents a false choice. We do not have to accept sedevacantism in order to reject the errors that have come into the church since the Second Vatican Council. Some will say that Pope Pius VI said that the church cannot offer mass that is harmful to souls. Therefore, if these are real popes, we cannot say that the new mass is harmful or invalid. First of all, the SSPX says that the new mass is valid, or at least it can be when done properly. And some, like Father Hess, say it was never properly promulgated. But the reality is Pope Pius VI was defending the traditional mass against those, the Jansenists, who wanted to introduce novelty into the liturgy through the Council of Pistoria and get rid of things that had been there for centuries, saying they were no longer useful. Sound familiar? Pope Pius VI condemned the Council of Pistoria, stating, quote, as if the church, which is ruled by the Spirit of God, could have established discipline, which is not only useless and burdensome for Christian liberty to endure, but which is even dangerous and harmful and leading to superstition and materialism, false, rash, scandalous, dangerous, offensive to pious ears, injurious to the church and to the Spirit of God by whom it is guided, at least erroneous. He was defending what was already in place against reform. That's it. After having looked at the claim of sedevacantism, comparing it to how the church has operated in the past, and what the church says about the permanence of the papacy and the hierarchy, we can say, no, this cannot be the answer. Then, taking into account that it's pretty clear from the First Vatican Council that the Pope is only guaranteed to be without error under certain conditions that none of this, including the Second Vatican Council, meet, and understanding that we cannot submit to error, we can apply the principles of resistance that saints and doctors say we should practice, which includes consecrating bishops so the traditional mass, rites, and teaching can survive the crisis. We're not saying the Pope doesn't have the authority to tell the SSPX no. If that were the case, they wouldn't have sought his approval in the first place. We are saying the state of necessity, the crisis in the church, warrants disobedience. And you guys can't have it both ways. You can't say, if Leo is truly the Pope, then this is schism and they are excommunicated. Because if Leo is the Pope, that presumes John Paul II was the Pope and the 1983 Code of Canon Law is in effect. And that Code of Canon Law allows provisions for acting under a state of necessity, whether real or perceived. Therefore, they are neither excommunicated nor in schism. And if you're right, then there's nothing to see here. They aren't doing anything different than you guys are doing, and there's no Pope to tell them no. So why you guys make these comments, I have no idea, other than you're trying to discredit the SSPX because you see them as competition. And something else I find interesting, all these prophecies that predicted the crisis that we're going through today with astonishing accuracy, and not one of them says that the chair of Peter will be empty? Fatima, Our Lady of Good Success, La Salette, not one of them. That seems like an awful big detail to leave out. In fact, they talk as if the papacy remains intact. La Salette says Rome will become the seat of the Antichrist, but that's not the same as saying the chair of Peter will be empty for an extended period of time. St. Francis said there would be one pope that was not canonically elected, but that's one pope, not 10 or whatever. But if you know of one that predicted a very long period of sede vacante that is approved by the church, let me know. And did you know that a group of people called the Luciferians questioned Pope Liberius's legitimacy due to his compromise with the Arians? And that there were a few groups who claimed that John XXII and his successors were not valid popes due to John's heresy? Does history judge these groups to have been correct? No. Nor will it modern sede vacantism. Until my next video, God bless.